This is Audible.
The Dead Daughter, Lee Calloway, Book 1. Written by Thomas Fincham. Narrated by Adam Verner. Chapter 1. Sharon Gardner woke up with a splitting headache. She shut her eyes and hoped the pain would go away, but it didn't. She squinted at the alarm clock on the side table. The time was well past 9 in the morning. Next to the clock was a half-empty glass of water, and next to it was a bottle of prescribed sleeping medication. She must have taken one too many. She had to be careful, though. She had once made the mistake of mixing alcohol with the pills. Had it not been for her husband, she probably would not have woken up that time. She looked over at the other side of the bed. Her husband was not there. She was not expecting him to be either. They had been going through a rough patch. They had fought many times before, but somehow they always managed to get back together. But this time was different. She knew her marriage was over, and it was her fault. She could not completely blame herself for it ending, though. There was not much love in the relationship to begin with. Hers was a marriage of necessity. Paul was a kind and caring man, and he loved and doted on their daughter. She got up from bed and moved to the bathroom. She turned on the light switch. The light nearly blinded her. She waited a few seconds and opened her eyes. She stared at herself in the mirror. She had shoulder-length hair that was dyed red. Her skin was smooth without a single wrinkle to be seen anywhere. This was not due to her age, but to the work of a highly skilled plastic surgeon. Her lips were plump and full, but recently they were looking a bit thinner. She would need to get them injected again. She turned her body to the side and examined her stomach. She was still in great shape. She used to be a cheerleader in high school. All the cool boys and jocks were after her. She knew the power her body had on men, which was why she still watched what she ate. Her shapely figure also benefited from her regular trips to the gym and yoga classes. She smiled at the last thought. She took a long shower. She normally took one before going to bed, but last night she lacked the time. The hot steam reinvigorated her mind and her body, and her headache dissolved in an instant. She dried herself and dressed in a jumpsuit before she made her way downstairs. She half expected her husband to be in the kitchen. He was an early riser, and he always put the coffee on to brew. But after their last argument, he was sleeping in the guest house. She walked over to the living room and peeked out the window. Odd. Paul's car is still in the driveway, she thought. He's normally at work by now. She walked back to the kitchen and proceeded to make breakfast. As she sat down to eat, a thought came to her mind. Where's Kyla? Their daughter was a junior at the local university. She was majoring in classical studies. Paul was dead set against it. He wasn't sure how learning about Greek and Roman history would help her get a job. Sharon agreed with him, but that did not mean she would go against her daughter's wishes. If Kyla wanted to study something with low employment potential, then so be it. The only thing that mattered was that her daughter was happy. Sharon walked down the hall and checked the home office. It used to be Paul's, but ever since Kyla began going to college, she had made it her study room. Her backpack and books were still on the table. Sharon returned to the kitchen and examined Kyla's semester schedule, which was stuck to the refrigerator door by a magnet. She had put her schedule there to remind herself of Kyla's class times. Sharon ran her finger over the dates. Kyla had Greek literature this morning. She shook her head. Kyla must have been out late last night with her friends. She was likely still in bed. On any other day, Sharon would have let her sleep. But her next class was only an hour away. If Sharon woke her up now, Kyla could definitely make it to class. She went upstairs and knocked on the bedroom door. Kyla, darling, it's morning, and you're late for class. She waited, and when there was no response, she knocked again. Kyla, you're late for class, she said. She turned the door handle and found her door was unlocked. "Darling, I'm going to come in," she warned in case her daughter got mad at her for barging in. The room was dark, but Sharon could see an outline on the bed.
"Kyla," she whispered, "it's time to get up."
She flipped the light switch. Her hand instantly went over her mouth to stifle a scream. Kyla Gardner lay on the bed with her eyes closed. The front of her dress was soaked in red, and so was the pillow and bedsheet. Sharon ran out into the hall, fell to her knees, and began to wail in agony. Chapter 2. Detective Gregory Holt had thick arms, thick hands, and a thick neck. His head was shaved clean, and the skin on his head was wrinkled. His eyes were small and black, and they darted from one spot to another as if taking everything in. His shirt collar was tied around his neck, but he made no effort to loosen the button. Holt was 6'4" and weighed close to 250 pounds. He rubbed the wedding ring on his finger 3 times. He did this before every new investigation. The gesture reminded him of why he chose to be a detective. He wanted to protect his loved ones. And to do that, he had to put criminals behind bars. Holt graduated from the police academy first in his class. He rose through the ranks, starting as a patrol officer, then making detective, and rising all the way to staff sergeant. He missed being a detective, however, and to the dismay of his wife, he requested a demotion. He felt he could do more good on the streets than behind a desk. He made his way up to the house. There was a black Audi and a silver Lexus parked in the driveway. They looked shinier than his 10-year-old Toyota Camry. His wife had been bugging him to upgrade to a newer model, but he knew it would be tight on his detective salary. Maybe he could have considered it when he was a staff sergeant, but that was behind him. His wife enjoyed driving her 2-year-old Prius, which he paid for. Her happiness meant more to him than anything else in the world. So what if he owned a decade-old car? It didn't bother him, so why should it bother anyone else? He knew he would have to make sacrifices when he gave up the extra pay in the coroner office. Detective work involved long hours and a ton of grunt work. The rewards only came when he solved a case. And most cases ended up turning cold. Greg Holt loved every minute as a detective, though. The rush of adrenaline when he chased a lead. The satisfaction when he put a perpetrator in jail. There was nothing that compared to that. He turned and took a look back. A strand of yellow police tape circled the front of the property. Good, he thought. I don't want anyone messing up my crime scene. He went inside the house. He was approached by a uniformed police officer. The officer recognized him and eased up. Where is it? Holt demanded. Upstairs, the second bedroom on the right, the officer replied. Holt took each step deliberately. He was never in a hurry for anything. There was no point in rushing. He would eventually get there. He entered the room and found a woman leaning over a body on the bed. Detective Dana Fisher was 5'5", 110 pounds, and she had dark shoulder-length hair. Her green eyes were large and expressive. Her nose was thin and pointed upwards, and it moved whenever she opened her mouth. Fisher had moved up the ranks like Holt, but she made it known to those around her that she would not stop until she became captain. Holt admired her ambitions, but he felt she was better suited for detective work. That did not mean he would not support her if an opportunity for promotion ever arose. Plus, he liked working with her. She was as determined to solve a case as he was.
"You want to fill me in?" he asked her.
Chapter 3. The victim is Caucasian, age 20, around 5'3" by my estimate, Fisher replied. And from a cursory examination, it looks like she was stabbed to death. Holt leaned over and saw thick blood spread across the victim's chest. Her eyes were closed, but it was easy to see she was young. She had long blonde hair that fell across the pillow. Her lips were thin and parted, exposing 2 of her front teeth. Her face was round and had started to turn puffy. Holt knew from experience that when the organ stopped functioning, the body started to retain water. Fisher said, "I don't see any lacerations on any part of her body except the chest."
"You think she was stabbed while asleep?"
he asked. "That would be my guess, what with the amount of blood around her."
"Looks like she was still dressed from the night before," Holt said.
The victim was wearing a light blue dress that went down to her knees, and she still had on matching colored high heels.
"So she comes home after a party and goes straight to bed," Holt said. "Then someone enters her room and stabs her?"
Fisher looked at him. "Do you think it was an intruder?"
"We can check the locks to see if it was a break and enter."
Holt thought of something.
"Who found the body?"
"The mother."
"Where was she last night?"
"I haven't had a chance to speak to her yet." It was Fisher's turn to think of something. "What if the victim dressed for the party but never left?"
"That's plausible."
There was commotion out in the hall. They heard voices. They turned when a man came racing into the room.
"Where is she? Let me see her!"
he yelled. Holt stuck his massive arm out to stop the man from getting near the body. The last thing he wanted was the bereaved contaminating the crime scene. The same police officer from downstairs came into the room.
"I tried to stop him, but he got through," he said.
Holt glared at him. The officer's incompetence nearly destroyed evidence that might be in the room. Holt gently but forcibly escorted the man back out into the hall.
"That's my daughter,"
the man said, pointing into the room.
"Your name, sir?" Holt asked.
"Paul Gardner,"
he replied between heavy breaths. Paul Gardner was slim, with thinning hair. He had stubble on his cheeks from the night before. He looked to be 5'7" and close to 150 pounds. He wore round spectacles, and his eyes were glassy and moist.
"Mr. Gardner, I need you to calm down."
"How is Kyla?" Paul asked. "Is she okay?"
"I'm afraid not," Holt replied.
"What happened to her?"
"If you let us do our job, we might have answers for you."
Hot tears began to stream down Gardner's face. Holt suddenly felt sorry for him. No parent deserved to see their child this way. It was beyond cruel. Holt turned to the officer standing next to Gardner.
"Please escort Mr. Gardner back downstairs and make sure he stays there until we are done."
"Yes, sir,"
the officer said, eager to make up for his earlier mistake. The officer placed his hand on Gardner's elbow, turned him around, and led him down the hall. Fisher said, "Look." Holt turned to her. She nodded toward Gardner. Holt was still confused. "His shirt," Fisher said. Holt looked and his eyes widened. There was a red stain on the back of Gardner's golf shirt.
"Wait," Holt said.
He moved toward Gardner. He got closer and he knew instantly what the stain was. Blood.
"Were you in the room earlier?" Holt asked.
Gardner looked confused.
"No."
Holt pointed at the blood stain.
"Can you explain how you got that on your clothing?"
Gardner blinked.
"I have no idea."
Holt looked over at Fisher. He could tell she was thinking the same thing.
"Mr. Gardner," Holt said, "do you mind going to the Milton PD to answer a few questions?"
"Why?"
"It would help us get a better understanding of what's going on."
"Am I under arrest?"
Gardner asked, looking a little bewildered.
"No, but it would be better if you did so voluntarily."
Gardner stared at Holt. He then glanced over at Fisher and then at the officer.
"Please, Mr. Gardner," Holt said, his voice steely and commanding. "It is in your best interest to cooperate with us. We are here to help."
Gardner swallowed. He then nodded. Holt turned back to the officer.
"Have someone drive Mr. Gardner to the station."
"I'll do it myself," the officer said. He wanted Holt to know he could be relied upon.
"Good," Holt said.
Chapter 4. Strong winds forced the water onto the sandy beach. The sounds were both peaceful and violent at the same time. Lee Calloway lay on his stomach with his mouth wide open. His left leg hung over the bed while his right arm was underneath his chin. Drool had accumulated over his hand as he snored in unison with the crashing waves. The house was a stone's throw from the water. The home was worth close to $2 million, and it came with its own private beach. Calloway did not have the money to afford such a place. He was broke, and he had been for some time. The only reason he was allowed to stay in such an exclusive property was because of a client. The soon-to-be-divorced Marla Westerhaus was in line to receive her husband's $100 million real estate empire. Claude Westerhaus was a savvy investor, a brilliant businessman, and a world-class philanderer. Claude prided himself for having a keen eye for investment properties and for being a ladies' man. In some circles, he was nicknamed Casanova Claude. Claude relished this title bestowed upon him. His wife, however, loathed that nickname with a vengeance. Claude was not even discreet in his affairs. He took his girlfriends and mistresses to the same restaurants he took his wife to. The first time Marla laid eyes on Claude was when he was sweeping floors at a French bistro. He had strong arms and a wide chest. He had a prominent nose and a well-defined chin. His hairline was receding, but that did not deter him from chatting up the ladies. Marla had known for a long time their marriage was over. She stayed with Claude because she loved him and kept believing he would change. She also knew how vindictive he could be. The divorce would be anything but amicable. Claude already had money hidden in offshore accounts under numbered companies, behind layers and layers of corporate structures. If Claude wanted the money to disappear, he could do it with a snap of a finger. His numerous lawyers, accountants, and loyal employees would make sure not a trace of that money led to Claude. Marla would not see a penny once the assets were divided up. Marla never cared for the money, even though she enjoyed the comfortable life. Who did not? But what she valued more was respect. As his wife, Claude had embarrassed her by sleeping around with multiple women. Even her friends had begun to pity her for the way she had been tossed aside. She was older than him by a good 5 years, and as such, she sometimes looked like his mother. She spent money on makeup and minor cosmetic enhancements, but she knew she would never be able to compete with the younger girls. What irked her most was the fact that she had believed in Claude before anyone else did. She used to work at a bank as an investment consultant. She knew the value of saving money, and she also knew where to invest that saved money. She preferred stocks and bonds. She avoided mutual funds as she deemed them too risky. But when the housing market began to appreciate during the 90s, well before the crash, she got involved in a construction project. To protect her investment, Claude volunteered to keep an eye on it. If the project failed to meet certain deadlines, they would pull their money out. He quickly realized he enjoyed overseeing the construction from start to finish. To top it off, they made a good return on their investment. Marla pulled all her savings, cashed in her 401k, and begged her friends and family for loans in order to fund Claude's very first project, which then led to many bigger projects. Had she not taught him what she knew, he would still be sweeping floors at the French bistro. Marla was determined to divorce Claude, and she was determined to teach him a lesson for all the pain she had endured. She was searching for a private investigator when she stumbled upon Calloway's website. She hired him to follow her cheating husband as he went about his many rendezvous. Calloway caught Claude with multiple women. Some were models who had not caught their big break yet, some were students looking to pay their way through school, and some were even high-priced escorts who enjoyed the lifestyle the profession afforded them. None of them gave Marla enough leverage on Claude. If she confronted him, he would not deny the affairs. He would rub them in her face to show he was still virile after all these years. He would then goad her to divorce him, knowing she would be left with nothing. Calloway was persistent. He never gave up on finding something on Claude. He hit the jackpot one night when he caught Claude with an attractive blonde woman. He later found out this woman was married to a Russian oligarch who was rumored to be linked to the KGB. With this information in hand, Marla confronted Claude. He tried to deny this affair, but the photos were irrefutable. They caught him in various compromising positions. Claude was smart enough to know what would happen to him if these photos were to reach the oligarch. He tried to buy the photos off Calloway. The sum was far more than what Marla had paid him. Calloway refused. He always completed his contract, and he never betrayed a client. Marla took Claude to the cleaners. She got the real estate business and the investment properties. She left Claude with enough money to start another business, but this time, he could do so without her encouragement and support. As a thank you, she let Calloway stay at her beach house however long he wanted. She was in Switzerland at the time, enjoying the life of a single woman. Calloway got up and off the bed. He was tall, tanned, and had strands of silver around his temples. He yawned and stretched his body. He glanced out the window and saw the waves crashing onto the beach. He grinned. "Maybe after I make my coffee, I'll go down and relax on the sand," he thought. Chapter 5. Fisher said, "How do you suppose Paul Gardner got blood on his shirt?" Holt was wondering the exact same thing, but the man's emotion was genuine. Gardner was in anguish when he saw his daughter. Holt had investigated many murders, and he knew enough by now to know who was suffering and who was faking it. Even then, there was no denying the fact that Gardner might have evidence on his clothing. Holt never liked to jump to conclusions, especially this early in the case. He knew it could derail the entire investigation. Instead of focusing on multiple suspects, the search would become myopic, diverting the police from catching the real killer. But Holt knew what he saw. It was blood. There was no doubt about it.
"Let's search the house," he said. "We still need to find the murder weapon."
"I'll check downstairs," she said. He nodded and moved to the master bedroom. It was spacious, with bay windows and a fireplace. Holt never understood the point of having a fireplace in the bedroom. Fireplaces used to serve a purpose. They were a place where families would gather around to stay warm. Now, with HVAC systems, the entire house could be heated with the switch of a button. A king-size bed was in the middle of the room, and across from it was a dresser and a mirror. Nightstands flanked the bed. Holt walked over to one and grabbed a small prescription bottle. They were sleeping pills, and the prescription was made out to Sharon Gardner. He did a quick walkthrough of the other rooms before he made his way downstairs. There he found the medical examiner and her team entering the premises.
"It's the bedroom on the right," he said, pointing up.
The medical examiner gave Holt a nod.
"You're not joining me, Detective Holt?" she asked.
"I'll be there in a minute."
He watched her go up the stairs. He moved to the kitchen, and through the glass sliding doors, he saw Fisher in the backyard. He stepped out, walked around a patio set and a small garden, and made his way to her. "It's the guest house," she said, pointing to a structure the size of a two-car garage. It had a brick exterior, a window, and front door. "Apparently Paul Gardner was sleeping here last night," she said.
"How'd you find that out?"
"The wife." He nodded and went inside. The space was open but cozy. A futon was in the corner.
"Gardner must have slept there," Holt thought.
Next to the futon was a recliner which faced a flat-screen TV. There was another window and door on the other side of the guest house. "It's the bathroom," Fisher said, catching him staring at the door. "I'm surprised it doesn't have a kitchen. Most guest houses I've seen do."
"How many guest houses have you seen?" Holt asked.
She shrugged. "Okay, fine, I've never been in a guest house, but I've seen enough on TV." Holt knew Fisher lived in a cramped one-bedroom apartment. She had talked about buying a house or a condo, but with the sudden rise in home prices, she was always finding herself priced out of the market. At the rate housing prices were escalating, she would be lucky to find a fixer-upper. But that was another reason she wanted to move up in the force. The extra pay would go a long way in helping her become a homeowner. There was a coffee table in the middle of the room. Sitting on the table was a bottle of scotch and a half-empty glass. Holt walked over to the table, and with gloved hands, he picked up the bottle and glass.
"It might be better if we bagged these," he said.
Chapter 6. The medical examiner's name was Andrea Wakefield. She was petite, with short cropped hair and round prescription glasses. Her eyes darted inquisitively over the victim's body, as if she was recording and storing all pertinent information in the back of her mind. "I can confirm the victim suffered external as well as internal wounds. The punctures in the upper chest are indicative that she was stabbed. The amount of blood loss further supports this conclusion. I counted 4 puncture wounds, but after an autopsy, I can give you a more definitive number. However, I don't think she died from these wounds."
Holt blinked. "Then how did she die?"
"The victim was choked." Holt's eyelids rapidly twitched.
"What?"
Wakefield pointed to the neck. "The bruising around the victim's throat and neck leads me to believe that she was strangled, possibly by bare hands. The marks aren't straight or aligned. The pressure applied by the hand is never consistent. This tells me that a rope or cord was not used. I will further confirm this during the autopsy, of course."
"But how do you know she died from strangulation?"
Wakefield looked at Holt like he had asked a stupid question. Maybe he had, but he would have to wait for her answer to find out. She paused to better articulate her response. "It doesn't make sense for someone to stab her and then choke her. It would serve no purpose. It makes more sense if the opposite occurred. The perpetrator choked her, and then, just to be safe, he stabbed her."
"Who would do such a thing?" Holt asked.
An image of a suspect was forming in his head, but he wanted her opinion on it. Wakefield came across as introverted, shy, and even aloof, but she was fiercely intelligent and took her job seriously. Over the years, Holt had come to rely on her expertise. It was born out of necessity. A medical examiner's professional opinion mattered greatly in a court of law. If the ME's findings were flawed or without merit, the entire case could be thrown out. Right then, if Wakefield said the victim died of natural causes, regardless of the condition of her body, Holt would have to give her conclusion serious consideration. If they did not work in unity, they had no chance of getting a conviction. Wakefield paused again, considering all scenarios. "This could be a crime of passion. The person responsible may have become enraged, at which time he or she, more likely he, as men exert more brute force, decided to lash out at the victim. Once he realized what he had done, he then stabbed her to finish the job, as they say." Holt pondered Wakefield's words. They made sense.
"What happened here?"
Holt asked, pointing to the victim's mouth. There was swelling on the right side of her upper lip. "The victim suffered a cut, most likely during the altercation that led to her death." Wakefield pulled back the upper lip, exposing a deep red gash. "When the victim was struck, the lip split open when it came in contact with one of the front teeth." Holt nodded. He moved away from the body as if to distance himself from the crime itself. He wanted to let the information sink in before he made any further conclusions. He did a quick scan of the room. The bed was in the middle, and it had a dresser across from it. Next to the bed was the closet, and on the other side of the wall was a bookshelf. Holt moved his fingers across the book's spines. They were mostly romance novels, with a few erotica mixed in. The only reason Holt knew the genres was because his wife was an avid reader. She could read a book a day. He had even seen her go through 10 books in a single week. He never understood her fascination with the written word. The last time he read a book cover to cover was when he was in high school, and that was only for his English class. His life was already filled with so much excitement that he did not need stories to keep him entertained. But the books did tell him something about the victim. She could have been a romantic at heart.
Could her murder be the result of a relationship gone wrong, he thought.
"Are you done?" The medical examiner's voice snapped him out of his reverie. He turned to her and blinked. "Do you want to take another look, or can I take it away?" she asked. He stared at Kyla Gardner's lifeless body. She looked almost peaceful in her current state.
"No,
I'm done, he replied.
Chapter 7. Holt went back downstairs. He found Fisher in the home office. She was seated in front of a laptop. The property is surrounded by security cameras, she said, her eyes transfixed on the screen.
Did any of them capture anything useful? He asked.
All the images are stored on the laptop's hard drive. Hopefully it has what we are looking for. He positioned himself behind her so as to get a better view of the monitor. The images were separated into four squares that took up the entire screen. They were black and white, but they were in high resolution. The top left image showed the driveway. Holt could see the family's cars parked there. The top right camera was aimed at the front door. Members of the crime scene unit were going in and out of the house. The camera on the bottom left showed the back of the house. Holt could see the sliding doors that led from the kitchen to the backyard. The bottom right camera faced the guest house. There was no movement there at the moment. Let's see how this works, Fisher said, fiddling with the keys and the mouse. She pressed a button, and the images began to move in reverse. She pressed the button again. People and cars zoomed in and out of the frames at higher speeds. She pressed the button once more, and the images slowed to their regular pace. We should start from when the family got home, she said. Holt watched as Alexis pulled into the driveway. The time on the clock read 8:42 p.m. A woman got out of Alexis. She was carrying shopping bags. Holt could only assume it was Mrs. Gardner. He still had not spoken to her. In the video, she walked up to the front door and disappeared from view. They watched as the time ticked by on the screen. Close to an hour later, an Audi pulled up next to the Lexus. Paul Gardner emerged from the driver's side door. He was wearing the same golf shirt that later got a red stain. Holt squinted and leaned closer to the monitor. Gardner looked casual as he removed a briefcase from the back seat, closed the door, and pressed a button on his car key. The Audi's headlights blinked as the doors automatically locked. He then flipped through his key ring, found the right one, and made his way up to the front door. He then disappeared from view. Holt's eyes focused. Gardner did not look like someone who would be responsible for a horrific crime later that night, but then again, the medical examiner believed it was a crime of passion, so anything was possible. A couple of minutes later, Gardner appeared at the back of the house. He was still carrying the briefcase in one hand, but he was holding a bottle in the other. Most likely the same bottle of scotch found on the coffee table in the guest house. Could alcohol have played a factor in what happened? Holt wondered. Alcohol had the power to change people, often for the worse. The quiet became loud, the meek became bold, the peaceful became violent. Gardner walked up to the guest house and went inside. Holt and Fisher waited for something to happen. When nothing did, Fisher clicked on the button to speed up the images. They watched as the clock ticked at the bottom of the screen. Suddenly, all four screens went blank, and just as suddenly they came back up. Stop, Holt said. Go back. The screen went blank, and then the images reappeared. Let it play, Holt said. They watched as the seconds ticked by. At precisely 11:34 p.m., the screen went blank. When it reappeared, the clock read 2:38 a.m.
What happened to the 3 hours in between? Holt asked, confused.
I have no idea, Fisher replied. It looks like someone turned off the cameras.
Holt's face darkened. Chapter 8. Sharon Gardner tightly hugged herself. Even though she had a shawl over her shoulders, she still shivered. Her eyes were red and raw, and every so often she would break down in tears. Holt and Fisher sat across from her on the living room sofa. Holt let her grieve. Nothing compared to the loss of a child. He believed in the old saying, time heals all wounds, but only up to a point. Time would not heal Sharon's wounds over losing Kyla when she was so young. Each year, she would be reminded of what could have been had Kyla been alive. she would carry this weight for the rest of her life. Fisher took the lead, and Holt was grateful she did. Talking with grieving people was never easy. She said, "Mrs. Gardner, can you tell us what happened last night?" "Call me Sharon." Fisher gave her a smile. "Okay." Sharon grabbed a tissue, wiped her nose, and said, "I came home from shopping last night. I had a headache, so I took my sleeping medication and I went straight to bed."
"That explains the glass of water and the pills," Holt thought.
"What about your daughter?" Fisher asked.
"What about her?"
"Was she home when you got back from shopping?"
Sharon looked away, thinking. "I'm not sure. I never went to her room to check. Maybe I should have."
She bit her bottom lip to control her emotions.
"Kyla's an adult, so I've stopped monitoring where she goes and when she comes back. I wanted her to have as much independence as possible. My husband, on the other hand, thought we should pay more attention to who she hung around with. He was worried something bad could happen to her."
Fisher jumped right in.
"Speaking of your husband, are you and him going through a separation? We noticed his belongings in the guest house."
Holt understood why Fisher asked such a question. Sometimes during a nasty divorce or separation, one parent may lash out at the children out of spite to hurt the other parent. This resulted in many cases of murder-suicide.
"We didn't want our family and friends to know just yet, but Paul and I are separated. We just haven't filed the divorce paperwork yet."
"And how is your daughter dealing with this situation?"
"I thought she was handling it better than we were. Paul and I have been married from the time Kyla was born. There have been many good years in the marriage, but also many bad years. Kyla saw how unhappy we were, and she encouraged us to split. We never did it before, because Paul and I are both children of divorced parents. We know how it impacted us growing up, and we didn't want Kyla to go through that."
"And how is your husband handling the separation?" Fisher asked.
"Paul's a quiet and reserved person. He doesn't let out his emotions easily. I'm the opposite. I can be loud and erratic when I'm worked up. Maybe that's why our marriage didn't last. But to answer your question, I don't know how Paul's dealing with the situation. Maybe you can ask him yourself. Do you know where he is? I haven't seen him since I woke up this morning."
"So she doesn't know her husband is at the police station," Holt thought.
Holt said,
"Did you notice anything unusual about your husband when you woke him up?"
"Like what?" Sharon asked, confused.
"Was he acting suspiciously?"
She looked away again.
"I don't know. I don't know anything."
She put her hands over her face. Holt let silence fill the room for a moment.
"Mrs. Gardner, Sharon, can you remember anything from your interaction with your husband?" he asked.
She sighed. "After I called 911, I ran straight to the guest house. I found him sleeping on the recliner. I called out his name, but he did not wake up. I yelled, and still he did not stir. For a second, I thought he was dead."
"Dead?"
Holt said. She nodded.
"Paul's not a deep sleeper. But this morning I couldn't get him to open his eyes. When the officer arrived at the house, I explained to him what was going on, and he had to physically shake Paul awake. When I told Paul about Kyla, he ran out of the guest house and into the house."
"By then, we were at the scene examining the body," Holt thought.
Sharon said, "After that, I don't know where Paul went." Holt thought of something.
"When we were going through your security cameras, we noticed that for a couple of hours the cameras were turned off. Do you know why?"
She stared at them.
"I'm not sure. They are always on during the night and even the day when we are not home."
"Are they automatically turned on? Or do you have to do it manually?" Fisher asked.
"Manually. They are linked to our home alarm."
"Who knows the passwords?"
"I do. And Paul and Kyla, too."
Holt said,
"Would your husband have a reason to turn them off?"
"I don't know. But why would he?"
"That's something we will ask him," he thought.
A member of the crime scene unit entered the room.
"You guys need to see this," he said.
They followed him outside. He led them to the Audi and pointed to the glove compartment. Fisher grabbed a pair of latex gloves and leaned in. She pulled out what looked like a kitchen knife. The blade was stained with blood. Holt turned to Sharon.
"Whose car is this?"
He already knew the answer, but he wanted to see Sharon's reaction. Her eyes were full of disbelief.
"It's my husband's car," she replied.
Chapter 9. The Callaway Private Investigation Office was located above a soup and noodle restaurant. To get to his office, you had to go behind the building, take the narrow metal stairs up, and knock on a black metal door. There were no signs outside informing patrons that such an office existed. There were two reasons for that. One, there was no space to put a sign. Two, Callaway didn't want unexpected visitors. Over the years, his reckless behavior had gotten him in trouble more times than he could count. There were wives whose husbands were looking for him because he had gotten involved with them. There were unsavory people he had borrowed money from that he never paid back. There were even old landlords to whom he had neglected to pay rent before he up and left. Callaway resented his actions. He never imagined he would become one of those people who were always taking advantage of others. He firmly believed he was not. The wives he slept with, their husbands were doing the same thing. In fact, the wives were mostly his clients. They had hired him to dig up dirt on their cheating husbands. These women had been ignored, disrespected, and even abused in some cases. He made them feel beautiful and worthy again. He had always vowed to stop mixing business with pleasure, but it was far harder than it seemed. The money he owed was mostly to criminals and lowlifes. They had not gotten their money the right way, and as such, Callaway did not feel too guilty for keeping some of it. He had also vowed to stop associating with such people. They were known to get physically violent when they did not get their money back. As far as the landlords were concerned, most of them barely took care of their property, and a lot of their properties were not even up to code. The first landlord Callaway refused to pay was because the roof was so badly leaking that there was a strong possibility it would cave in. The second landlord would shut off the heat during the winter to save money, and the last landlord did little about the rat infestation. His current landlord was not any better. His unit had no air conditioning, and during the winter months, the heating barely warmed the small room. To make matters worse, the room was cramped and windowless. Even if Callaway wanted to install an air conditioner on his own dime, there was no window to set one up in. During the summer months, though, Callaway would leave the front door open and place a running fan in front of it, allowing cool air to circulate through the room. When the room turned chilly in the winter, Callaway would run a small heater, which he hid behind a banker's box underneath his desk. If his landlord ever paid him a surprise visit, she would never know he had one. She had repeatedly complained about how high her electricity bill had become ever since he moved in. He could tell her off if he wanted to, but he was not a tenant who paid his rent on time. It was better to keep his grievances to himself. In short, he had become the cliched private investigator from the pulp mysteries he had read as a kid. He drank, he gambled, he womanized, and most times he did not have two pennies to rub together. He also had an ex-wife and daughter he barely saw. His life was anything but desirable, and he had no one to blame but himself. Callaway was once a deputy sheriff in a small town. He had a house, a wife, and a small child. The money was stable, and the crime rate was close to non-existent. It was a quiet and peaceful existence. It should have been enough for any sensible man. But Callaway was anything but sensible. He wanted excitement and adventure, and when he moved to Milton, he got that and more. There was even danger to contend with. When confronted with the truth, a few cheating husbands had resorted to pulling a gun on him. If it were not for his quick thinking, he would not still be alive. He shut the door to his office and took a seat behind a small desk. There was a sofa in the corner, which Callaway had come to use as a bed.
He was glad he did not need it at the moment. The beach house was far more comfortable than the springy sofa. He removed a laptop from his bag and placed it on his desk. While the computer loaded, he grabbed the remote and turned on the flat-screen TV, which hung on the wall. The TV was the only expensive item in the office. A client had gifted it to him a couple of months ago, right after Calloway had been kicked out of his apartment. The TV was always tuned to the 24-hour news channel. Calloway wanted to know what was happening in the city. This allowed him to seek out potential clients. He pulled out his cell phone and checked his messages. That was another reason Calloway did not need a sign outside his office. If people wanted to get in touch with him, they could always call him. He knew word of mouth was the best advertisement. Old clients were always referring him to new ones. Every once in a while, he would drop a business card where he thought someone could use his services. His website had his contact information, and a telephone number was taped on his office door. If someone ever called, they did not need to meet him at his office either. His motto was, "Don't come to me, I'll come to you." Chapter 10. Paul Gardner was still dressed in the clothes he was wearing when he first met the detectives, including the blood-stained golf shirt. A police officer had not left Gardner's side at any time, even when he went to the bathroom. There was no telling what Gardner could do to the evidence if he was left alone. Holt stared at him across the table. Gardner looked dazed and confused. He asked every so often why he was at the police station and not at home with his family. He complained of a headache and asked for painkillers. He was provided a cup of coffee instead. The department was not about to provide medication to a suspect unless it was on the advice of a medical professional. Holt now believed Gardner was the sole suspect in this case. It was just a matter of how long it took for him to confess. "Can you tell me what's going on?" Gardner asked, almost pleading. Fisher, who was sitting next to Holt, said, "Mr. Gardner, your daughter was found dead in her bedroom. Do you know how that could have happened?"
"How would I know? And why are you asking me this?"
Gardner shot back. Fisher ignored Gardner's question. "Do you know how you got blood on your shirt?" Holt wanted to seize the golf shirt as evidence, but he could not do that until they arrested Gardner. There should be no doubt to a judge or jury that the evidence was found on Gardner, not planted by the police after the fact.
"I have no idea how it got on me," Gardner said.
"Do I need a lawyer?"
"You're entitled to one, but you are not under arrest. We are just having a conversation."
"It feels like I'm being interrogated."
Holt moved forward, his elbows on the table.
"We're just trying to find out how your daughter ended up dead."
Gardner stared at him and nodded. Fisher said,
"Can you go over what happened last night? And please, don't spare any details. It could be vital."
"Where do you want me to start?" Gardner asked.
"From the time you got home."
Gardner took a deep breath.
"Okay. Let me see. I came back from work, and I went straight to the guest house."
"What happened next?" Fisher asked.
"I had a glass of scotch and watched some TV."
"Do you drink every night?"
"No, I'm not a big drinker. But yesterday I had a tough day at work."
"What do you do?"
"I'm president and CEO of a small software company. We create apps for mobile devices."
"So you went to the guest house and had a drink. Then what?" Fisher asked.
"I watched a basketball game."
"Who was playing?"
Gardner closed his eyes a moment.
"Cleveland and Golden State."
"Who won?"
"I'm not sure. It was a late game. I fell asleep before the start of the fourth quarter."
"What time was it?"
"What time was what?"
"What time did you fall asleep?"
Gardner licked his lips.
"I don't know, 11 or 11:30, maybe?"
Holt placed his palm on the table.
"Do you know why anyone would turn off the security cameras?"
"What?"
Gardner replied, surprised.
"We leave them on all night?"
"They weren't on last night."
"How could that be? I didn't disable them. I was in the guest house all night."
"You said your company makes apps for mobile devices, is that correct?"
Holt asked.
"Yes."
"What kind of apps?"
We're a boutique software company. We make products based on customer demands. If a restaurant owner wants to know how much money is going in and out of his cash register in real time, we can create an app that links the software in the register to the app.
Can you link your home security system to an app? Holt asked.
Of course. It's now become standard with all security devices.
Do you have such an app on your phone?
Gardner opened his mouth, but then stopped. After a brief pause, he said,
I do.
An awkward silence filled the interrogation room. Fisher said, What's your relationship with your daughter?
I love Kyla. She's my little girl.
Gardner's eyes turned moist, but he quickly controlled his emotions. He looked Holt and Fisher directly in the eye.
I know what you guys are thinking, but I did not hurt my daughter. I can't imagine anyone doing that to their own child.
Fisher changed the subject.
What's your relationship with your wife?
Gardner sat back in his chair and crossed his arms.
You can tell from the way we are sleeping in separate beds that it's not great.
Why is that?
Are you married? Gardner asked.
Fisher shook her head. But Detective Holt's been married for 23 years, she said. Gardner turned to Holt.
Then you know the problems married couples go through.
Holt did. Marriage was not just about two people vowing to stay together through the good times and bad times. Marriage was about giving up a lot of yourself for the other person. Holt had sacrificed so much for the sake of the union, but he did not regret anything he had given up. He could not imagine his life without Nancy. Fisher said, After you fell asleep, what happened?
The next thing I remember, it's morning, and I was woken up by a police officer. I asked what was going on, and Sharon told me about Kyla. I didn't believe her at first. Sharon was hysterical and not making any sense. I rushed over to the house to see for myself, and that's when I saw you guys.
So far, Gardner's story matched what they had learned from the surveillance footage and Sharon's statement. But there was one thing missing. There was blood on the side of the Audi's passenger door, which prompted the CSU officer to examine the car. Holt believed the blood could only have come from Gardner's shirt, and the blood on the shirt could only have come from Kyla. Holt said,
We found a knife covered in blood in the glove compartment of your vehicle. Do you want to explain how it got there?
Gardner's face turned pale.
I think I would like to speak to my lawyer now.
That's a good idea, Holt said.
He turned to Fisher and nodded. She stood up and said, Paul Gardner, you are under arrest for the murder of Kyla Gardner.
Chapter 11.
Calloway decided to go to a diner and have breakfast. He had enjoyed a cup of coffee at the beach house, but there was no solid food in stock there. His stomach rumbled as he walked the block to the restaurant. Jolie Patterson was behind the counter, serving hungry customers. She had blonde hair she liked to keep pulled back in a ponytail. She had on a tight-fitting t-shirt with an apron on top. The half-full restaurant had plenty of places to sit this time in the morning. Normally, Calloway would sit in one of the back corner booths, keeping away from the crowd, but today he grabbed a stool and sat at the counter. Jolie came over.
I've only seen you once since you came back from Fairview. Were you working on another case? She asked.
Unlike other people, Jolie was enamored with Calloway's chosen profession. She, too, wanted more out of her life. She had dreamed of being a singer, but instead of following her dreams, she got married and then pregnant. Her then-husband worked as an equipment manager for a local rock band. He was away for long periods at a time when the band was on the road. After their last tour, he never came back. He called her from some town.